So, welcome. Thanks for joining something you probably have little idea what it is. And so I'm always grateful for folks who are just willing to show up and see what happens. I'm Wes Howard Brook, if you hadn't figured that out. What I want to do this week is, in a way, a continuation of what I was doing last week, but that's in no way meant to say that you needed to have been here last week. But what I want to work with are some themes from my recent book, Come Out, My People, God's Call Out of Empire in the Bible and Beyond. And as Walter and I were just discussing before this started, already questions that are so relevant to our world sometimes put us in categories that we're not clear exactly what we're talking about unless we specify. For example, I asked Walter was interested in empire, and I said, what exactly are you interested in? And he talked about how some secularized voices, I don't know if it said nations or people, but some element of secularization is at work, you know, in various ways in empires. And I asked the question, what exactly do you mean by secular? And he was referring to people who are not religious. And that quickly led us into the question of what exactly do we mean by religion, which I think ought to be the starting point here. Because one thing I do in this book, and I'll just say it, and then maybe I'll suggest a little why I thought it's important to start there, is to try to use the word religion in its Latin root, religio, which means to bind again. Because I think a couple of things happen. We either make religion too broad or too narrow. We make it too narrow, in a sense, when we think of the, what I sometimes call the name brand religions, Judaism, Christianity, Islam, you know, as if those were a clear thing that we know what we mean when we say them. Christianity. Like, who's Christianity? You know, the fundamentalists, Holden Village, the Pope, emerging churches, your neighbor down the street. And the more we think about that word, the more we recognize people can use the word Christianity to refer to a wide range of things that have little in common except maybe they have something to do with somebody named Jesus. But that might be all they have in common, the relationship with the Bible, or how they relate to our world, or whether it's primarily about me and Jesus, or is it about us and Jesus, vary tremendously. So when we hear words like Christian or Jewish, sometimes we think we know what we're talking about, but with just a little of unpacking, we can recognize those words are not very clear. On the other end, when we use religion in the sense of name brand, I think we miss a lot of what it is that powerfully can bind people together as a people that doesn't fit in the categories of the name brand religions. So again, for example, Walter mentioned Hitler. And I don't want to paraphrase you so or quote you incorrectly, so feel free to fix this if I don't name it accurately. But I think you said that Hitler was not religious, but he used religion.
Is that close there too? Yeah, close.
Do you want to fix it a little bit if I said it not quite right?
Hitler was, in a way, taking over the established church at that time and gaining leaders of the church to underwrite what he was doing. But I don't think that he was looking to God the Father or to Christ for guidance in what he was doing, but taking those religious leaders as pawns. And we're thinking about what religion means, but I did not think of that as being religious activity on his part, having more to do with faith rather than binding together.
Fair enough. And I think the point you're making is a very important distinction, but one I want to invite us to consider reshaping a little bit so we don't miss how religion, in the sense that I'm suggesting, what bind the worldview and practices that bind people together as a people. When we use that category, religion, as the name brand religions, we miss a lot of, in the broader sense, religious activity that very successfully binds people together and leads them to do things that Jesus said people to do, but not necessarily in the same way, like to lay down their lives, to be willing to go to war for the cause. So in that sense, not just the National Socialist state of Germany, but I'd suggest patriotism or nationalism is a religion. It might have no reference to God the Father and the Trinity and all the things that we think of as religion in the Jewish or Christian or biblical sense, But it is religious in that people, because of the American flag or because of other symbols of nationalism, feel bound together, are willing to die for the cause, are willing to define an us over against a them. And as Americans, we know that's been our history all along, whether that's indigenous people of the continent or people from Africa or ideologically communists or nowadays terrorists or Muslims. If we can use that broader sense of religion, we can recognize that religions come on a spectrum of strength and weakness. So Hitler's religion, certainly not the religion of Jesus by any stretch, and using the upholders of that, the supposed upholders of that, for his ideological purposes, but it was a very strong religion. It took a people, and it's precisely his purpose, was to take a German people who sort of lost sense of who they were because of the defeat of World War I and because of the ravages of the Depression, and purposely meant to bind them together as this Aryan race, in quotes, to strengthen the health of the German people. And of course, he was often referred to as a savior, the German people. There are also weak religions, and I don't want to spend a lot of time on that, but just to get you thinking about the difference. Sports partisanship binds people together. And in a religious way, in that people wear similar clothes, they have rituals that they participate in that makes them bound as Cubs fans or whatever it might be. But I'd say it's a weak religion. Most people, as far as I see, aren't willing to kill or die for the Cubs. Especially for the Cubs.
Or the Twins.
Hey.
Or the Twins. Or the Mariners, for that matter.
How about the Giants? Yeah, I'm trying to wake up with the papers to the Tigers one.
So when I work with young people in college who, especially in the Seattle area, fall in that famous category, spiritual but not religious, I want to get them to think further about that. Are you a completely isolated individual, or is there something that binds you together with other people? An example from a student of mine who self-identified as Indonesian. I was trying to make a point about how some ethnic identities are functions of empire, that the word Indonesian isn't anybody's indigenous word from those islands. It's from the Greek word, you know, meaning islands in the Indian, you know, Indian islands. And I said, What to you makes you Indonesian? And without hesitation, she said, for Indonesians here at Seattle U, there are two things that make us Indonesian. We have to have two Apple products. To be Indonesian means you have to have at least two Apple computer products. An iPhone, an iPod, an iPhone, and an Mac. That was her self-proclaimed sense of what bound them together. And corporations, I think, better than most of us, and certainly better than most of us are willing to acknowledge, understand what's at stake in this sense of religion. No company has ever understood that better than Coca-Cola, as far as I can tell. Coca-Cola's campaigns were precisely framed religious statements meant to bind people together. I don't know if you recall or have you ever seen those 1970s Coke commercials, I'd like to buy the world a Coke. We could all live in perfect harmony. It was the early 70s. It was during the Vietnam War. It was after the civil rights movement and the women's movement. And it was just when Watergate was starting. And America was very much in turmoil. And, you know, shows like All in the Family were illustrating the generation gap and all those things. And those Coke commercials show people all holding a candle.
Yeah.
In every racial and ethnic face you could imagine, all singing together in perfect harmony the Coca-Cola song. So if we give up religion and ideology and all this stuff and everybody drank Coca-Cola, the world would be united. And we can laugh, and we should laugh, but that was the point of those commercials.
And isn't Coca-Cola owned by the Mormons?
No, actually, it's not owned by the Mormons. It's owned, the founders of Coca-Cola, the Candlers, basically own Atlanta. They financed the Graduate School of Theology at, Emory University there in Atlanta. And so that's another story. Okay, so Now, Coca-Cola is powerful at doing what it does, but it's still a weak religion. You know, most people are not going to get angry versus Coke versus Pepsi, you know, or Coke versus coffee. But it's a religious claim in that broader sense. What I'm trying to suggest in this book is that that kind of religion, of, you know, or the broader sense of that kind of religion, of binding people together, is always at work. In that sense, nobody, except some isolated individual who has no contact, maybe the Unabomber, who consciously made a point of putting himself in a place where he was not connected to other people, the rest of us who are social and have networks of connection with other people are necessarily, in that sense, religious. We may never go to church, we might not confess anything about a God, but we're bound together with other people to make us, give us a sense of an us. Although in our culture, with technology and the institutionalization of many things that we used to have to rely on each other for, many people don't have a strong religion. Many people just have weak religions. You know, name brand identification and things like that. For the people, the ancient people that we know as Israel, their sense of religion, of course, coalesced around one thing they had in common, that the object of their worship was a god named Yahweh. But other than that, when you read the Hebrew scripture, you find that there's an incredibly wide range of viewpoints of who that Yahweh is, how that Yahweh is to be experienced, what that Yahweh wants from people, what it means to be Yahweh's people. And the basic premise then of the book is that the Hebrew scripture texts coalesce at two ends of a spectrum. One end of that spectrum I call the religion of empire, and one the religion of creation. And let me just bring up something that might help illustrate this so it's not too abstract. Although it'll still be a little abstract until we start to look at the text. So, this isn't all of it, but I wanted to be big enough so you could see it on the screen. So, here you have in the center of the religion of creation, on the right, religion of empire, on the left, elements of what any full religion would claim to provide. So, the first thing, of course, is where is divine power? Where does it come from? In the religion of creation, it comes from the one God who's the creator of heaven and earth. In the religion of empire, it's almost always multiple gods and goddesses. Similarly, God's home in the religion of creation is both beyond and within creation and among people, whereas in the religion of empire, it's almost always in a temple near the palace in the royal city. Note that, these elements not only express some sense of who Yahweh is in the Hebrew Bible, but express who Marduk was for the Babylonians, or who the gods were for the Egyptians, or for the Romans. This pattern would fit any cultural manifestation in the broad sense of the religion of empire, of the worldview and the rituals that hold people together within an imperial context. So as we look at a few New Testament texts this week, I'm hoping to illustrate what we find when we look at the other end of the book in this chart, table 26, if you're counting at home, which is that when Jesus enters the scene, he upholds what I'm calling the religion of creation as authentic, as truly what the God he's come to know wants, and who that God is in and through Jesus and beyond, and denounces systematically the religion of empire as a demonic substitute, counterfeit. And so what I have on this chart is, you know, the same themes that we saw in table one, and then what Jesus says, what the supporters of empire say, and how Jesus responds to them. And systematically, I hope you can see that Jesus stands, for example, with egalitarian kinship as a social structure as opposed to hierarchical patronage. That for Jesus, economics is a matter of exchange of gifts rather than of money and debt. For Jesus, and Laurel's working with us to show how this may develop out in Jesus' own consciousness, God's people are anybody who, as we hear in Mark's gospel, hears the word of God and does it. All from all elements of human existence. Whereas in the religion of empire, there's always an us and them. There's always insiders and outsiders, defined countless ways: gender, ethnicity, economic status, social status, nationality, etc., etc. And in the religion of empire, it's perfectly justified in God or the God's eyes to uphold those separations with violence. Violence is an appropriate and necessary means to keep the separation. And of course, Jesus rejects violence altogether as a solution or response to anything. Okay, so just questions, observations about the basic premise here before I try to before I invite us into looking at a particular passage from Mark's Gospel today. That makes sense? Is it confusing?
I think I've got a pretty good handle on religion of empire, but I wonder if you could say more about religion of creation.
Well, is there something in particular you, or just you want me to talk about it for a minute? Religion of creation is primarily that it starts from the experience of the sacred in creation and among people. So, for example, where does Jesus encounter God? Where does Jesus encounter God?
With the least and the outcast and with everyone.
Among the outcasts? But how about on the earth? Where does Jesus go? The mountains?
Wilderness.
Wilderness?
The lake?
Lake? River? You see? When he goes to the synagogue, from the Greek gathered together, all he experiences there are unclean spirits. He never experiences God in the synagogue. He never experiences God in the temple. The God that Jesus knows is the Creator. And Jesus encounters that God, this is pretty easy for Holden people, on the earth. The story we'll look at today, when the disciples are, totally confused about who God is and what Jesus has to do with that, he takes them to a high mountain. Okay. Other aspects of the religion, the religion of creation is, in narrative terms, not in historical terms, I don't want to be too confusing there in making that distinction, but in narrative terms, starts with Genesis. And we'll look at that in particular tomorrow when we look at Matthew's Gospel, where translations cover up something that's really important to hear, where Jesus tells his disciples who are confused about the relationship between wealth and blessing, that when it's Genesis again, certain things will follow. So Genesis is the starting point, of course, the beginning, establishing the premises of the religion of creation. So it's the one Creator who makes everybody and everything, and it's all good. And all people have the image of God within us. And explicitly in Genesis 1, 26 and 27, male and female, which would have been shocking in a patriarchal society. All people. Genesis isn't about a chosen people, Israel, or a promised land that you can defend with imperial violence. It's about the entire creation is sacred, and all of God's people and everything that populates creation is good. And Genesis presents, a little bit I was looking at last week, some particular examples of what the religion of creation looks like as opposed to the religion of empire. One place where it's crystal clear is how in Genesis 18 and 19, the hospitality that Abraham and Sarah offer to the visitors under the tree, it's on the earth, is diametrically opposed to the rejection of hospitality by the people of Sodom, who see strangers as a threat and something to be defended against with violence, the exact same people. So as a human family, then, what we call economics, or the law of the house, or to put it in simplest terms, economics is, what do we do with our stuff? What's our relationship with our stuff? This economics, huh? Where's it come from? Who's it belong to? What's it for? That's economics. It can become, in our world of expertise, this, distancing thing where economists tell you about economics. But, economics is house stuff. And, so, for example, one thing we almost all experience, regardless of our religion in the formal sense, is that in the household, stuff belongs to everybody in the household. Do you parcel out the food in your refrigerator as what belongs to whom?
Well.
You may have some special leftover that you saved, or a cookie that, you know, was yours and you were waiting to...
cat food.
But in general, food is provided as a gift. You don't charge your kids and charge your kids for dinner, did you? I hope. You know, they didn't eat only if they did their homework or their chores. Food is a gift. The furniture and the warmth and the embrace of the house belongs to people in the house. The only question is, who gets to be in the house? But once you're in the house, it's a gift. It's not for sale. The religion of creation extends that sense of who's in the house, or who's potentially in the house, to everybody. And that's, of course, the challenge, because we've inherited big chunks of the religion of empire that teach us to be suspicious of strangers. Going to say, this is for me and mine, and you have to take care of yourself. You're not my problem. You know, I'm not my brother or sister's keeper. Okay? I don't know if that answers if you had a specific question there, Laurel, or...
That helps a lot.
Okay, good. So, what I want to do each day this week is take a passage from each of the four Gospels, and then we'll culminate with the Book of Revelation, and illustrate this. And then Sue is going to be following up in her session with the same passages of what does this say to our own spiritual formation and the kind of disciplines and practices that we can do to continue to hear, have ears to hear, and to embody the religion of creation which Jesus proclaimed, and to have expelled from us, exercised from us, the religion of empire that competes for our hearts and minds. Okay? So I hope you'll participate with me as we look at some of these passages. Now, this is in Mark's Gospel, chapter 8, and it comes, not surprisingly, after chapter 7. Isn't that, boy, that's why I get the big bucks, right? What happened in the previous chapters was a large crowd, and then another large crowd where people were fed. And then we get this scene in the beginning of chapter 8, just to set the narrative context. So the Pharisees try to argue with him, asking for a sign, and he sighed deeply in his spirit. The Greek is actually stronger than that. Why does this generation ask for a sign? Truly, I tell you, no sign will be given this generation. I want to highlight that because the word generation is going to be important for our passage. When you hear the word generation, what do you hear in that? What's that word suggest to you?
40 years.
Hmm?
Is it 40 years?
40 years, perhaps, like the Israelites in the wilderness. What else do you hear the word generation?
Your parents, your grandparents. Your
so this genealogical sequence that defines a family, and what generation is one unit of that. Okay. Anything else you hear in the word generation?
It's never good.
It's never, yeah, it's always adulterous or sinful. Or
it's these days.
Somebody else going to say something?
Generate.
Generate, like to be generative, to make things happen. Those who can generate, yeah. So we have a lot of connotations of the word generation in English, and that's why I want to bring those out to highlight that the core meaning of the Greek genea here, generation, has to do with people who were bound together by a common ethnicity or way of thinking and acting. So it's not primarily about the biological sequence, nor is it primarily temporal. That's what often people miss when, in the scene we're going to look at, you know, this generation will not pass away, and we think, you mean none of the people happen to be alive right now? But it has to do with the people who are bound together by a defining something. And, of course, genealogy is one way that people are bound together, one way among many. All right. So, this generation asks for a sign, and Jesus has nothing to do with it, and they get in the boat, he gets in the boat with the disciples, and they'd forgotten to bring bread except one loaf. And he tells them to watch out for the yeast of the Pharisees and the yeast of Herod. And they said, it's because we have no bread. And I love this scene because it takes away anything you have of Jesus being nice and sweet. And he just rails on them with a series of questions. Why are you talking about having no bread? Do you still not perceive or understand? Are your hearts hardened? You have eyes and fail to see? Do you have ears and fail to hear? And do you not remember? That's a load of stuff to lay on them just because they said we have no bread.
Didn't plan ahead.
Yeah, they didn't plan ahead in more ways than one. And so he basically tells them their senses are not working, right? With their hearts, their eyes, their ears. And then he gives them a little math problem. But the 5 loaves of the 5,000, how many baskets? And they get the math answer right, 12. And then 7 for 4,000, and they get that right, 7. He goes, now do you understand? And you're thinking, I don't either, aren't you? No, which I think is part of the point. So I want to highlight, that's where the disciples were in the story here. Asking questions about bread, and Jesus talking metaphorically, of course, something about the Pharisees and something about Herod that they should be aware of and watch out for. And so the next few chapters are all about teaching them to see and hear and open their hearts with examples from other people. It's what Laurel's and Sue's mutual friend Chad Myers talks about in his book on Mark's Gospels, the discipleship chiasm, catechism. Chiasm is a different context. Discipleship catechism, a series of lessons to teach the disciples how to actually be his followers. Okay, and the starting one is about someone who is blind and can't see, and it takes 2 steps to heal him. They look like trees, and then he touches them again, and he can see. And then we get to this scene we're looking at today. So, he went with the disciples to the villages of Caesarea Philippi. Why does that matter? Caesarea Philippi, what's that? Where is that? Why does that matter that they went there?
It's not Israel, it's Gentiles.
Gentiles? Why would Jesus want to take them to a Gentile country?
That's a good question.
Okay. What else? Have a sense of where it is geographically in relation to the other places that
it's
Jesus and the disciples are?
It's the capital of the empire. It's an
associated... Well, it's certainly associated with empire. It's got the name Caesar in it. That's pretty clear. Do you have a sense of where it is in terms of north and south?
North end of the lake, isn't it?
It's above the lake, yeah. It's north above the Sea of Galilee. So Jesus starts his ministry gathering people around the Sea of Galilee, and he's working the Galilean region, and momentarily he's going to talk to them about going to Jerusalem. You know, and we know what's going to happen to him there, and he's going to tell them what's going to happen, but they don't want to hear it. So he's taken them as far away from Jerusalem as he can and still stay within this land. It's what, before the empire took it over, would have been the northern region of Israel as opposed to Judah. And that's important, although I'm not sure we'll get to every detail here. All right. So then he asked 2 questions. Who do people say that I am, and who do you say that I am? And, you know, as Laurel's going to show us by taking one little passage and working it all week, it always pays to look closely at every detail. I'm going to do something a little different this week where we're just going to glimpse at 5 different passages to get a bigger map of the New Testament. So I won't stop at every word, but if something jumps out at you you want to ask about or comment on, feel free. So the buzz, what people are saying, are actually odd answers. They're saying you're John the Baptist. Well, what's that imply? John the Baptist, what state is John the Baptist in at this point? He's dead. So how could Jesus be John the Baptist? They're clearly two different people, right?
They thought he came back again.
Back from the dead, here he is.
So they were contemporaries.
They're contemporaries, and John announced Jesus, John baptized Jesus in the Jordan, right? And he announced the coming of this more powerful one than I, and he's dead. What kind of sense of the relationship of life and death does it imply? They think that Jesus could be somebody who he knew, who's now dead, and now John the Baptist could be in Jesus. Like, that's interesting. Or Elijah. Why would they think that Jesus was Elijah? What would that imply? A prophet, but no... Elijah is distinguished here from one of the prophets. Still others, one of the prophets.
The prophet who's supposed to come back before the Messiah.
The prophet who's supposed to come back before the Messiah, according to the last word of the book of Malachi. The last book in the canon of prophets before the Jerusalem temple elite decided, because they said so, the era of prophecy is over. We've declared. I mean, think about what that's saying. They've said, we say God will no longer speak through prophets. And we ought to know, because we're in charge. Otherwise, what basis did they have for saying that? Of course, Mark's gospel and all the gospels say that's nonsense. John the Baptist is clearly acting as a prophet. And the era of prophecy is not over, and the people in Jerusalem do not have authority to make those kinds of decisions. But that's, we're nodding at that because we're followers of Jesus. What we're saying is the religious establishment doesn't know what they're talking about, which has implications in our world, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Perhaps. I mean, if you said that, made a broad statement like that in your church, you know, none of the ordained anybody have any clue what they're talking about. Right, Joan?
Amen, brother.
Yeah. I mean, those might be fighting words, at least controversial ones. So to say that he's John the Baptist or Elijah or one of the prophets is saying that the kind of people that God speaks through. And he said, what do you say? And Peter said, you're the Messiah. And I know it's on the screen and you know the answer. But don't you want to say, right answer? Right? Good job, Peter. That's the way we hear it in Matthew's gospel. You know, flesh and blood hasn't revealed this to you, you know, Simon son of Jonah. Now you're the rock and, you know, and you get the prize package and the big house and the car and the power and, you know. But that there's none of that in Mark. In fact, most literally what it says in verse 30, and Jesus said, shut up and don't tell anybody that. The word is really strong. It says here, sternly ordered. It's translated a few verses down as rebuke. But it basically means just shut up. Like, don't be saying that. That's the right answer. It's the right answer from the first verse of this gospel. The first verse of Mark is the beginning of the good news of Jesus, the Messiah.
And furthermore, you ask me who I am.
Yeah, and you got the right answer. You said, shut up. So let's go a couple more verses and look back at why he might be telling them to shut up and what this might have to do with the religion of creation, the religion of empire. Then he began to teach them that the Son of Man must undergo great suffering and be rejected by the elders, the chief priests, and the scribes, and be killed. After 3 days, rise again. And he said all this quite openly, and Peter took him aside and told him to shut up. Right? It's the same word. So this is tough stuff here, right? Anytime you think that, like, arguing in church is impolite and, you know, and wrong, go back to this passage. You know, this mutual shutting up stuff here. You shut up. No, you shut up. You know? And, in fact, that's what happens. He turned, looked at the disciples, and he told Peter to shut up again and said, get behind me, Satan. You're setting your mind not on divine things, but on human things. So, right at the very center of Mark's gospel, Jesus takes the disciples to far away from Jerusalem, and he puts to them the central question of, where is this whole thing going, folks? What do you think this is leading to? When Jesus says you're the Messiah, what do you imagine he's thinking this is leading to, that Jesus needs to silence? Who is a Messiah that Jesus might be calling on? Jesus is certainly not the only Messiah there's ever been. There were plenty of people who were Messiahs in Israel before Jesus. Can you think of any? Does that seem like a trick question? Well, what's the word Messiah mean?
Anointed.
Anointed. So who's anointed?
Moses. Abraham.
Abraham is not ever said to be anointed as such. He's right. Certainly got a relationship with God. He's never said to be anointed.
Kings.
Kings. Like who?
Oh,
Solomon.
Yeah.
Solomon and his dad, David, right? And Saul. All anointed by Samuel. Not Solomon, but Saul and David. Anointed, which is to say literally, a ritual of pouring oil over somebody to publicly signify that this is the one that God has chosen to be our king. Even though the very question of having a king, according to 1 Samuel 8, is suspicious, you know, we want to have a king so we can be like all the other nations. And when Samuel goes up to Yahweh to talk about it and takes it personally, Yahweh says, it's not about you, Samuel, it's about me. When wanting to have a king, they've rejected me as being their king. But you go ahead and tell them what having a king will be like. And in 1 Samuel 8, there's one verb that's used six times that defines what kings are. It's an operative verb that tells you what a king does. Take. Kings will take. They'll take your money, your produce, your children. They'll take, and then you'll cry out to Yahweh or God, and then Yahweh won't listen. So that's the warning. But they go ahead, and they anoint these human beings as kings, as Yahweh's anointed. And those people claim divine authority to be warriors, basically. Although Solomon sits at home. Solomon's administrator. Solomon is to David what Michael Corleone is to Vito. And I'd suggest the parallel actually runs pretty close. You know, Vito Corleone and David the King are very close parallels. You know? You seen Godfather 2? The one that is the backstory that shows how Vito got to be, grew up and became Marlon Brando? You know? Have you ever seen Godfather 2? One Best Picture? No? You should see it. So you know Godfather 1, right? The old Godfather is presiding, and it's at, you know, at this wedding, and people are doing the back room and fulfilling promises, and he's making offers you can't refuse and all that stuff. Well, in the backstory, they were Sicilian immigrants, and one of the former Sicilian extortionate gang leaders from the so-called Black Hand was going around the local businesses and basically saying, if you don't pay me, I'll cause you trouble. And that comes close to young Vito's life, and he quietly and apparently secretly, but not quite so, kills the extortioner. And people see him as a hero and come to him and ask him favors so that he'll do more of that kind of what Walter Wing calls redemptive violence. You know, protecting the people through acts of murder. And power comes to him, and the more power that comes to him, the more his violence is legitimized, and he becomes this revered figure and lives in this nice house and has a fancy wedding and all that. And then Michael inherits the power. Al Pacino, you know. Inherits the power just like Solomon inherits the power. And his job is just to hold on to it. So Solomon's job is to take everything that David has taken, including Jerusalem itself, after all, which David stole from the people whose city it was, the Jebusites, and hold on to it and to legitimize it. So if you ever, I guess if you didn't see Godfather 2, you probably didn't see Godfather 3. In Godfather 3, each of the stories begins with a religious event. So Godfather 1 begins with a wedding, Catholic wedding, and Godfather 2 begins with First Communion. And Godfather 3 begins with Michael Corleone getting an award from the Vatican, the medal, the honor of the Order of St. Sebastian. Why? Because he's made a $100 million donation to bail out the Vatican Bank from its troubles. Much like Solomon. So, a Messiah like David is what Peter's hoping for. This warrior king who will come and whoop the Romans, huh? Yeah, and I'd suggest, I don't have that much time left today, and we barely touched on the passage, but the first day is going to be more of that. Then we'll get more of the passage, and we'll come back to it in a second. I'd say that if you ask first century eudaioi, the Greek word that's often misleadingly translated as Jews, but really means Judeans, people of the region of Judea. What's the central religious issue of your time? What do you think they would say? It's a big religious question for a first century Judean. You'd think you'd want to know the answer to this, to know what Jesus' response to that question is, right? Because if Jesus isn't dealing with what people's central religious question is, then what's the point? Like, if there's a big question left after Jesus said and done everything he's going to do, then what about the answer to that question? So what is that question? I was already hinting at it, but...
You're talking about the first century after Jesus' death.
No, in Jesus' lifetime.
Okay.
What's the big religious question for Judeans? Is this...
Who's going to save us from the Romans?
Exactly! That's the question. Where is God in the process of liberating us from the Romans? How is God going to save us from the Romans? That's the religious question. Not is there a God and kind of what rules do we need to follow? And it's what about the almost literally goddamn Romans? And I use that in the most literal sense. You know, these people who they understand is condemned for not being obedient to Yahweh, and yet they're in charge. So they search the scriptures, and we'll look at that more with the Road to Emmaus story on Wednesday, wondering what are going to be the signs, how are we going to know that God's doing something? What are we looking for to answer the question of what's God going to do from the Romans? And one of the big answers would be a Messiah. You know, someone like David, or more recently in memory, someone like, say, Judas Maccabee, who defeated the empire of that time, the Greek offshoot known as the Seleucids, descendants of Alexander the Great's empire, by starting what is all too familiar to us, a guerrilla insurgency. You know, in the face of the Greeks saying, "We've come to bring you civilization and the gift of the Greek culture." And the indigenous people say, "We're not interested." And they say, "But it's a gift, and you have to take it, or we'll kill you." And they say, "Like hell you will, it's our land, get the hell out of here." And they start a guerrilla army. Sounds like a familiar pattern, doesn't it?
And then they have the nerve to fight on the Sabbath.
And they have the nerve to fight on the Sabbath, yeah. And that's another story. So whether it's the ancient story of David or the more recent story of the Maccabees, people are expecting that God will anoint someone who's charisma and strength and power will motivate people to the war against the Romans. And Jesus says, shut up about that. Instead, he goes to two other elements in the story, in the narrative of Scripture. Isaiah and the suffering servant. Four suffering servant stories in so-called second Isaiah. And another place. So in the standard translations, we hear Son of Man. It could also be translated the human being or the human one. Where does that come from? Instead of Messiah, Jesus talks about Son of Man. Who? What's Son of Man?
Daniel.
What about Daniel? Keep going, Joan. You're on a roll. So it comes from the book of Daniel, and what's at issue there? Who's the Son of Man? Human one.
The one who saves him from the empire that's there. I always forget which one.
Yeah, how?
By divine.
Let's look.
Oh, good.
So this is Daniel 7, a passage that has a lot of resonance with our gospel text. The story world of Daniel, as you see from the first verse of chapter 7, is in the first year of King Belshazzar of Babylon. But anybody but a fundamentalist or, you know, scholar, with reader of Daniel, would say that Daniel was written exactly in the same context as the book of Maccabees, which is in the midst of the rule of the Seleucids, in particular their big, bad, evil king known as Antiochus IV Epiphanes. And Daniel has dreams and visions of a series of beasts, like lions and bears. And what they have in common is they're ravenous and predatory. So you see that they have strong teeth, and they devour things, and they break things into pieces. And later in the series of visions, it's quite explicit, thanks to the interpretation by the angel Gabriel, that these animals and beasts are symbols of empires. They're apocalyptic expressions of the reality behind the veil by which empires present themselves as divinely authorized, civilized institutions. That in reality, from God's perspective, they're nothing but beasts that ravage and tear and destroy. And after this series of beasts, Daniel continues to look terrified throughout this whole thing, although the Gabriel tells him not to be afraid, just as Jesus does. And then he sees here in verse 9, an ancient one took his throne, his clothing was white as snow, just like Jesus in Mark 9. And the hair of his head was like pure wool. His throne was fiery flames, wheels burning fire, a stream of fire, etc. 1,000 served him, and 10,000 and 10,000 stood attending. Court sat in judgment, and the books were opened. And there was the noise of the arrogant words that the horn was speaking. And that's Antiochus Epiphanes. And as you continue to watch in verse 13, I saw one like a human being coming with the clouds of heaven. And he came to the ancient one who was presented before him. To him was given dominion, glory, and kingship, that all peoples, nations, and languages should serve him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion that shall not pass away, and his kingship is one that shall never be destroyed. And Daniel is not, in his own context, talking at all about Jesus. But Jesus takes up the mantle of the Son of Man and claims it for himself. The immediate referent for Daniel's vision is probably the Archangel Michael, as is described later in Daniel chapter 12. which is part of the apocalyptic tradition in ancient Israel that we'll look at more on Friday when we look at the book of Revelation, that said, you know, that behind the veil, behind the screen, if you will, upon which earthly ordinary events happen, there's another reality. And in that reality, the real battle is taking place. It's the kind of thing that we hear in the Pauline letters about, you know, our war is not against flesh and blood, but against the principalities and powers. So, in other words, you can't destroy empire by killing the emperor. Because empire is more than just the particular people who happen to embody it in that moment.
Well, so you mean we haven't changed anything by killing Osama bin Laden?
Yeah, that's what I'm just thinking.
Imagine that. And Osama bin Laden wasn't empire anyway. He's a resistor to empire. You know, so he controlled territory and all that kind of stuff. I'm not defending him at all, but just to make distinctions here, it's not like he was in charge of an empire. He's more like Islamic version of the Maccabees. Right? Someone who uses his religious tradition to defend violence against the big bad empire. And I'm not defending the Maccabees either. This is an alternative to the Maccabees. Daniel's vision says, when you're fighting the violent battle down here, Maccabees, you're not even actually dealing with the real issue. The real issue is this cosmic issue. Battle of power between God and these beasts. And the one who truly gets authority from the one on the throne is one like a human being. Which brings us again back to Genesis. You hear the connection? How does that bring us back to Genesis 1? One like a human being who gets authority from the one on the throne. I mentioned it earlier.
You said they're made in the image of God, but we all have God in us.
Exactly. So one could say one who truly embodied the image of God as opposed to those who embody the image of beasts. Because sometimes we imagine that, okay, in Jesus, there's this thing called human nature, human condition, and there's this thing called God, and they're like two different things that are put together like oil and vinegar in the salad dressing. And you can shake them up, but if you let them rest, they'll separate because they're really not the same. But what our gospel is claiming, and what grounded in Daniel, and Daniel grounded in Genesis, which is, say, grounded in the texts that create the storyline of the religion of creation, is that when somebody truly rules in the image of God, they are ruling with divine authority. And that kind of authority is not like beasts. It's not violent. It's not grounded in devouring and destroying. It's grounded in, as Scott was naming from Matthew's gospel at Eucharist last night, vulnerability and love rather than violence. So Jesus, back in our gospel, is confronting the religion of empire version of the story with the religion of creation version of the story. That's what's at stake in the coming of Jesus. Is which of these stories of Scripture is really true? And I'd like to suggest that he's saying that if you're going to call yourself somebody who's bound together with other people around the name and person of Jesus, then what we're claiming is that the religion of creation is the truth and the religion of empire is a lie. Okay, so shut up about that Messiah stuff. Because it's really about the Daniel story merged with the Isaiah story, which is unique, starting with Mark's gospel, that nobody had anticipated connecting before. And so when Peter took him aside to rebuke him, he's saying, you know, I don't like that version of the story. That doesn't sound powerful. How is that going to get rid of the Romans? And Jesus says, you're thinking like Satan. So what is it to think like Satan? Again,
opposing God.
Opposing God, yeah. And although Genesis doesn't talk about Satan, Genesis narrates the beginning of God's creation in Genesis 1, of course, and in Genesis 10, a text we don't pay that much attention to, the beginning of a counter-creation. by a guy named Nimrod. It's the only time the Hebrew word bereshit, beginning, is used in Genesis. It's Genesis 1:1 and Genesis 10:10. There's a counter beginning. And literally in the Hebrew, it says, Nimrod built his kingdom in Yahweh's face. We could say in confrontation with Yahweh. Let's see whose kingdom is more powerful, yours or mine. Which creation will last? The creation of the Creator God or the imperial creation that humans make as a replacement for God's creation? And of course, in the Babylonian world, that meant building things like a ziggurat, which is a, you know, literally man-made mountain, as opposed to a real mountain, a God-made mountain. And that's what's at stake. So Satan comes within the apocalyptic tradition, starting with texts that most of us don't know, like 1 Enoch, which is a very important, probably the most important non-biblical text for understanding the New Testament. We'll talk about it a little more tomorrow when we look at Matthew. Drawing upon that sense that the way that Peter is thinking is not just different, it's motivated by the opposer. And then he calls the crowd and tells them about picking up their cross and saving their life, etc. And we won't get in that because I want to spend a few minutes setting Sue up for with the transfiguration story. So the disciples at this point are left going, what? Huh? You know, what's he talking about here? So he takes them up the mountain, just Peter, James, and John, apart by themselves, and that's a theme that Sue will pick up, the sense of being apart by themselves. And he was transfigured before them, and his clothes became dazzling white. And there's a clue there in the word for dazzling, which is only here in this version of the story. Matthew and Luke don't have the word for dazzling, the Greek stelbanta, which comes directly from here in Daniel 10. Speaking of the one like a human being, his body was like beryl, his face like lightning, his eyes like flaming torches, arms and legs like the gleam of burnished bronze, and the sounds of his words like the roar of a multitude, an image taken up in the book of Revelation, almost verbatim. Okay, so what they now experience is the truth of who Jesus is. And he appears there with Elijah and Moses, and then Peter, of course, still having no clue what's going on. Let's just stay here. He didn't know what he was to say. And then the cloud overshadowed them. Where else is a cloud overshadowed in Scripture? How about here in Exodus 4, where Moses was not able to enter the tent of meeting because the cloud had settled upon it. It's in the Greek, it's the same word. And the glory of the Lord filled the tabernacle, in Hebrew, the Mishkan, the desert shrine that the people made, according to my book, as a substitute for the temple. But we're not going to go there today. So he's calling up the imagery they now experience, not just something Jesus is telling them, but the experience in the dazzling white and the overshadowing cloud are elements of the Exodus and Daniel tradition that then lead to the key element here. This is my son, the beloved. Listen to him. And when they come down, they don't know what rising from the dead might mean. But then they asked him, why do the scribes say that Elijah must come first? And you see, I'm hoping to begin to see how what's at stake, not just in this scene, but throughout, is this battle between these two religions. The scribes clearly embody the religion of empire. And that's why Jesus has to then, when they finish the discipleship catechism, go to Jerusalem and take down the scribes and the Sadducees and the Pharisees and the priests, one after another. All the religious leaders who the disciples, obviously, as normal people, expect to be the ones who will tell them who God is. And so they say, after this experience, then why do the scribes say? And he says, they're right about Elijah, which is to say John the Baptist. But then he asked them the question, how then is it written about the Son of Man that he is to go through many sufferings and be treated with contempt? So he's trying to get them to trust not in the scribes, but in their own experience of the sacred. Their encounter with Jesus on the mountain. and the voice that says, this really is the one you should be listening to, because he's the beloved. And Sue will pick that up some more. So we just have about 5 minutes left. So just, I know that was a lot to cover in a first session, and tomorrow I'm going to assume that first stuff is more or less familiar, and then we'll look more closely at text. But questions or comments or observations about this text, or just about the bigger picture of where this is going?
The second, was somebody ahead of me? No.
No, you go ahead.
The second chart that you put up, just before you had the scripture from Mark.
Yeah.
What was talking, is that it right there?
Yep.
Yeah, it just brought up a question as you were reading these elements one at a time of how much structure of empire is in the modern mainline church.
Yeah. Yeah, and if I get to volume 2 of this book, which I'm hoping to do sometime, my task there is to show how the anti-imperial religion of Jesus became the imperial religion of Rome. So like to trace this up through Augustine when that synthesis gets settled after his City of God. But you're absolutely right. It doesn't start really with Constantine. Constantine is the culmination of something that happened over the couple hundred years before that. That enabled what looks to us like a complete betrayal. Or not, because some of us have been so brought up with an imperial church, like the churches that collaborated with the Nazis, including the Catholic Church that signed the Concordat, you know, etc., that we've actually forgotten or maybe even never heard what the actual good news of Jesus is and how radically contrary to how the churches have acted through the centuries the way of Jesus is.
And that's a pretty well-established culture today.
Yeah. Yeah, it sure is. And I think it's why so many young people are rejecting it. You know, because doesn't have any power that they're interested in. And when they're presented, my experience is when they're presented, no matter what their background, with some of what I've just shown you, and they begin to hear what Jesus is really about, they want more. But as one person who was in our group it was you, Joan, naming on Friday in Sue's session, remember what you said that I'm referring to here? About what happened when you ended up in Nebraska in relation to the gospel and your role as a pastor?
Oh, they don't want to hear the gospel. They don't want to hear the gospel. And they want to stick to us versus them. You know that dichotomy. We're saved. They're going to hell. And when you preach the gospel, they say, we've never heard a Lutheran pastor say the things you say.
Or as a Catholic priest in an area not far from mine, a very wealthy suburban area, said, if I start to proclaim what Jesus said about economics, they won't change their lives, they'll change their parish.
Yeah. Right. Diane and I do a fair amount of political reading, Andrew Bacevich and Chris Hedges.
Yeah.
And you read through these, and this is really good stuff, but I always look at the end of it and how do we respond to this? What action does it lead us to?
Isn't that wonderful? That's what Sue's session is about.
And
that's exactly why we're doing this in 2 parts.
Yeah, you know, we're doing a lot of talking here, and the question I just asked of how much empire is in today's mainline church,
yeah.
I'd sure like to see some substantial discussion on what do we do?
That's exactly why we're doing this in 2 parts. And we recognize, given the Holden schedule and the variety of opportunities, that we don't expect that everybody's going to come here and then go there. Some may go to Sue's and not go to mine, or vice versa, or pick one day and the other. But the necessity of what you're saying is certainly something we recognize. And in 1 hour, there's only so much you can do. That's why Laurel's got the luxury of taking a week for one text. You know?
At least we can do something.
Yeah, and you know, I mean, the simple answer to your righteous concern there, and I'm very grateful for you expressing it, is that, as Laurel was quoting from the book Ceremony, at least we need to know the power of our stories, because otherwise advertisers and the Tea Party and other people will tell the story their way, and that will become the defining story. This was founded as a Christian nation. And we are a Christian nation. Well, that's not the history version that I know, but if people keep saying it that way, then that'll become the story that people tell. Not the truth in some objective sense. Who cares about that? What matters is the story that people live by. You know? So one reason I give so much of my life's energy to engaging these ancient texts is I think the answer to bad Bible study is not no Bible study. The answer to bad Bible study is better Bible study. And that unless we are bonded together around Jesus in the stories that tell us who Jesus was and who we're to be as his disciples, then how? Where else do we start from to get to what does this mean for us now?
Sure.
You know, and many people don't. Many people say the Bible's too compromised. People can use it for what they want. Who needs it? Let's just make up a new story. I think an awful lot is lost in imagining an arrogance that we could just start from scratch and make up a new story that's going to have the power of these ancient stories. So we're out of time, but thank you so much for being willing to be here today. I know some of you are leaving tomorrow, so this is all you got. So thanks for
we're so glad it's good.
Choosing to be here for this much. I look forward to seeing some of you tomorrow. I think I'm on at 4 tomorrow. And Sue, you're on at 4 today?